from the tomb. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to them, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." Then Peter and the other disciple set out and went toward the tomb. The two were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent down to look in and saw that the linen wrappings lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came, following him, and went into the tomb. He saw the linen wrappings lying there, and the cloth that had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. Then the other disciple, who reached the tomb first, also went in, and he saw and believed. For as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. Then the disciples returned to their homes. But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had been lying, one at the head and the other at the feet. They said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "They have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." When she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him in Hebrew, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said to her, "Do not hold on to me, because I have not yet ascended to the Father. But go to my brothers and say to them, 'I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God.'" Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord," and she told them that he had said these things to her.
There we go. Last year, I reread a book that I had first picked up 15 years ago. It's called Blue Like Jazz by Donald Miller. Have any of you ever read this? Some of you have read this book. I reread it because someone had casually brought it into conversation with me. "Have you ever read Blue Like Jazz?" they wondered. "Yes, back when I was in college," I responded. Later, I went to my bookshelf and started skimming through it, making a mental note to read it again. The first time I read it, I remember how impactful Miller's words were to me at the time. He wrote about the Christian life in a way that my required graduate-level books for my master's program did not. Miller was funny and edgy and honest and unfiltered, something that my 23-year-old brain had yet to experience. I wanted to see if Miller's writing meant the same to me a decade and a half later. Did it still stand up? Did it still speak to me? After reading it the second time, the answer was no, it didn't. His writing did not speak to me like it had years before. It just wasn't the same. There were some really good parts to it, of course, don't get me wrong, but 15 years can be a long time, and I have changed since my initial run-through. But one part especially addressed me. It's the author's note. Who reads the author's note at the beginning? If I had read the author's note 15 years ago, I do not remember it having any sort of impact upon me the way that it did this time. So I'm going to read to you the author's note. It's short. It goes like this. I never liked jazz music because jazz music doesn't resolve. But when I was outside the Baghdad Theater in Portland, Oregon one night, I saw a man playing the saxophone. I stood there for 15 minutes and he never opened his eyes. After that, I liked jazz music. It's waiting for that. Sometimes you have to watch somebody love something before you can love it yourself. It's as if they are showing you the way. I like that. I like it because it's also been my experience, and Miller was able to give language to what I already knew is true. I think about baseball games and how when I went to games at the ballpark, I detected some people wearing headphones. And I asked one of them, "What are you doing?" And they told me, "I'm listening to the radio play-by-play announcers call the game." Next time I went to the ballpark, I brought along a portable radio I purchased at Walmart and plugged in my own earbuds. And it was like a whole new world opened up to me. I had no idea that listening to Eric Nadell or Milo Hamilton call the game while I sat in the stands would change the whole experience. Or take poetry. I never liked poetry in high school or in college or anywhere else for that matter until I went to my very first poetry reading. Before moving to Houston, Chelsea and I went on a whim to hear poet laureate Donald Hall read some of his works. And listening to the cadence with which he delivered them, the emphasis on certain phrases, the explanations on why he wrote it this way and not that way, revealing the stories behind the wordsmithed phrases, watching him changed poetry for me. And now I can't get enough of it. It means something different to me now. Or two Thursdays ago, for Chelsea's birthday, I took her to the Vincent van Gogh exhibit that's currently on display at the Museum of Fine Arts. Anyone else been there yet? Oh my goodness, cancel your Easter lunches. Go do that. I think it runs through May. I had known Van Gogh's most famous paintings, Starry Night and Sunflowers. I knew a bit about his life, his stay in the psychological hospital, how young he was when he died. But it wasn't until I stood in front of the paintings that I had never seen before that Van Gogh changed for me. We walked around with those tiny listening devices held up to our ears and recorded art historians with French accents educated us on what we were looking at. This one before you is the Restaurant de la Sirene, the narrator said. Here we are in a town outside Paris. Notice the name of the cafe up on the facade. From the balcony up there, patrons, while they ate, would watch the boats out on the river. Notice how your eyes are drawn to the red brick wall at the front. And do you see how the orange hues depict the sunset behind the building? Look how the colors play off of each other. It's like a stained glass. This one you're looking at is called Still Life with a Plate of Onions. What Van Gogh is doing in this painting is, the digital guide told us, he painted this one soon after being released from the hospital. Observe what's on that table. That right there is a letter from his brother Theo. That book was a popular handbook in the 19th century of medicines for health problems. The candle suggests dinner time, reading by the light of a tiny flame. The explainers of Vincent van Gogh saw what I did not see. They tuned my senses toward what I did see but did not understand. And in the process of listening to them love what they themselves were looking at, I grew to love it too. There's more I could talk about. It's like the time I saw a member of my church up in Oregon dig through a small trash can, grabbing used plastic forks and spoons so that she could recycle them at home later. Or when I hear Larry talk about the kingdom of God, or when I hear Lincoln give testimonies about God's goodness. Sometimes you have to watch somebody love something before you can love it yourself. It's like they are showing you the way. When we read John's account of the resurrection, as Dorian did for us just a few moments ago, I am struck by the fine, detailed particulars with which he writes. There's a specific day of the week. There's a wild foot race in the early morning dawn. There are used clothes neatly placed into a donation bag, since the former owner apparently won't be needing them after all. There are tears from a close friend, and there are suspect characters all about, including a shady landscaper. John draws his audience into the scenes, stands them before the crazy happenings of that morning, one that we've seen many times before, almost ad nauseum. In those details, it becomes clear that John loves this picture. And he loves telling the backstory of it at least once a year. Though you get the feeling he'd tell it more often if people would just stop to listen. It's like John handing us one of those tiny devices at the museum. "Hold this up to your ear," he says. "What is it that you hear?" Today, being what it is, we do stop, and what we hear in John's opening is the quick shuffling of three pairs of feet belonging to three persons we're already familiar with. In verses 1 and 2 of chapter 20, Mary discovers the stone to the tomb's entrance pushed aside, and she sprints back to tell Peter and the beloved disciple what she found. How these three characters respond to the Easter news dominates John's version of the story, and none of their responses are exactly the same. Which goes to show that the very same resurrection event can be experienced differently by different people at different times. How you experience Easter today may be different than how you did 10 years ago, and different than how you will 10 years from now. Thanks to John, our narrator, this morning you may notice reds and oranges you hadn't seen before, or the words written up on the facade. Later on, you may have a stronger appreciation of the elements on the table than you currently do. Your story, like these three people here, rises and lowers, nothing ever quite the same. The three persons offer us hope that there is more yet to learn, and they offer us grace in the places we find ourselves. Hearing their stories, we hear our own, as we are offered the same choices once given to Mary and to Peter and the beloved disciple. The beloved disciple is the one John calls the one whom Jesus loved. That nickname is a high designation for any person. Some people think that the one whom Jesus loved is John himself, the writer of this gospel. And that's a strong option, though no one really knows for certain. He shows up often in this gospel. He's at the Last Supper, the Passover meal in the upper room. Jesus has just washed his feet, knowing that one of the disciples in that room is about to betray him. And Peter, as they all are curious to whom it could be, and motions to the beloved disciple, "Ask him." And the disciple does, since he's sitting next to Jesus. He's also at the foot of the cross of Christ, standing nearby as Jesus dies up there. Four women and this man watch Jesus from the front row. The one whom Jesus loved is tasked with taking care of Jesus' mother, and he does. He shows up for the final time at the end of the book where he's trailing Peter and Jesus at the edges of their private conversation. And Peter inquires about him. The beloved disciple obviously has a close and special connection with Jesus, a brotherhood born from time and travel and trust, which are key in any kind of relationship. Jesus cared for this man, loved him, in fact, and vice versa. In the reading for today, the beloved disciple jumps up the second he hears Mary's news and runs to the cemetery to check it out himself, beating Peter to the finish line. His actions make sense, given that he chose to stay with Jesus all the way to the terrible end. Why would he not want to see what has happened now? The beloved reaches the tomb, and upon seeing the grave clothes lying there near the entrance, he falls to his knees in wonder, could it be? When he does venture in further and spots the head covering purposefully folded up, John says that even though he didn't get the full magnitude of what was going on, the one whom Jesus loved saw and believed. Next week, Chelsea will talk about what it means to not see and yet believe. We know people like the beloved disciple today. They're the ones who don't need mountains of evidence verifying Easter's worth. They're the ones whose verbal faith and external actions are one and the same. These are the people who tell you that though the oceans roar and the mountains quake, it will be okay. And God is going to take care of you. And you believe them. They will stand at the foot of other crosses and promise to take care of moms, not their own. They're the men who look at the crumbling neighborhood and see opportunity. They're the women who insist that the rambunctious child with limitless energy who runs recklessly around the auditorium will one day harness that energy and use it in spirited service toward the least of these. The funny thing is, it doesn't come across as rose-colored glasses or naive optimism. They have this unwavering trust in God the rest of us wish we could have. A trust that doesn't require much more proof for life after death than the clothes folded up in the corner. It's a genuine faith that God is here. We know people like this in our congregation, and we are much better people because of them. If the one whom Jesus loved is the one we aspire to become, Peter, for many of us, is our actual spirit animal, the one we are most like. A week ago, when Brittany and Mikey and I read from the Passion narrative, we heard Peter say this, "Lord, I am ready to go with you to prison and to death." A couple hours later, Peter at the campfire swore up and down he didn't know the man, followed by just about the most frightening text in the Bible for me. Just as Peter was speaking, the rooster crowed. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. And Peter remembered the word the Lord had spoken to him, "Before the rooster crows, you'll disown me." And he went outside and wept bitterly. Ah! Peter, the bold, the one with all the charisma to attract the crowds and leadership potential coming out of his ears and access to the inner circle of the Son of God. That guy turns into Peter, the utter coward. And Jesus looks right at him. How devastating is that? So why does Peter join the race to the tomb? Over the last few days, he's been running away from Jesus, hasn't he? And now he's running toward him. Why? We can make some guesses. His guilt, namely his shame. The significant weight he's carried on his shoulders and at his rock bottom, he goes back because of his failure to live up to what he was so quick to promise. Another guess could be that he's running out of jealousy. The neck and neck commentary John describes involving the beloved disciple and Peter is comical on one hand, but on the other hand, it's like a rivalry going on, a cynical animosity between the two. And deep down, Peter could be jealous of how good the beloved disciple always comes across. For his faith, for the fact that he did not run away when the cross was slotted upright into that hole in the ground. It's possible that the underlying tension is no longer dormant, symbolized by the mad dash to the tomb. Or perhaps Peter runs because there's a twinge of hope. Lazarus was raised from the dead. Could it have happened to Jesus too? Caleb will preach in a couple of weeks about Peter, so I won't say much more about him now other than this. Any way you look at him, many of us live with the same complexities that Peter did. Our promises to God we did not keep. Our mess-ups that keep us up in the middle of the night. Our jealousies for others' supposed belovedness. Our botched attempts to stay clean. Our efforts at self-preservation. It's scary to face the future knowing our past. Running away from Jesus was the best we could come up with at the time, and it seems most logical given how threatened we felt. It also seems logical that upon hearing that what you thought was gone may be there after all, you'd hurry back too. If there's even the slightest chance that Jesus could walk out of that grave pit, Peter is going to find out. Maybe he didn't cause as much damage as he first thought. When he gets to the tomb, he's afforded the first and best view of the interior. But Jesus, unfortunately, is not there waiting for him. Peter had gotten his hopes up too, and not to burst happy bubbles or anything, but Peter does not believe in the resurrection of Jesus based on the tomb's emptiness. We are only told that the one whom Jesus loved does. The vacant grave does not seem yet to have made a difference for Peter, and I am willing to bet he is not alone. How many of us get that? Feeling no increase in joy or hope or certainty this Easter morning. If you're looking for further insight, you won't find it in this vignette. Not yet, at least, because Peter and the beloved go back home. And John starts a new scene. This one stars our third character, known by the name of her village, Mary of Magdala, Mary the Magdalene. We learn from Luke's gospel that Mary had been healed by Jesus from evil spirits, that she had followed Jesus for the rest of his ministry. John's gospel tells us that Mary stood just yards away from the crimson cross as Jesus was executed like a convict. When the two men leave the cemetery, Mary cannot, and she just loses it. She's unable to hold herself together any longer. Her tears come in torrents right there against the tomb of the one who had rescued her, both from demons and despair. There is no more running for her. As the events of the last few days loop infinite in her mind, Mary would be just fine if she was the one dead and buried, because in her mind, most of her already is. In her grief, she can hardly think straight and can't see straight, for two angels show up and she doesn't recognize them as otherworldly. She doesn't recognize Jesus either, misidentifying him as the custodian of the grounds and accusing him of thievery. It's not until Jesus says her name, Mary, that she knows exactly who he is. Rabbi, teacher. All Mary wants to do is catch up with Jesus. How? What? Where? Why? How? But Jesus instead gives her a job to do. Go and tell. And Mary becomes the very first Easter preacher. I have seen the Lord. All sorts of wonderful things John wants us to hear about this sweeping picture, but let's just pick one. Mary looked right at Jesus, but didn't recognize him as Jesus, which is odd, but not abnormal. Jesus was not where he was supposed to be. I think about those videos showing a military dad who's come home and his children don't know he's home, and yet he's there at the kids' school, and it takes about 5 seconds for them to realize who he is. And then the shock on the kids' faces make you weep as they run and cling to him. You've seen those. He wasn't supposed to be here, and Jesus wasn't supposed to be here. He was supposed to be dead and gone and buried. Of course Mary didn't recognize him until he spoke her name. Mary. Look around this room and you know stories of people who've been named by God. Before then, their selfie pictures were confusing and blurred. The color schemes were odd and off. They had seen Jesus all right and heard of Jesus, knew of his cross, done the church thing, but they could not see with the eyes of faith to recognize his living presence until he called them by name. And at just the right moments, Jesus spoke their names aloud. Mary, Stanley, Joyce, Kumi, Stu, Lupe, bringing forth a growing awareness of the one who is ahead of them and with them and for them. It led to baptism. It led to joy. It led to a calling. Go and tell. They tell about life to a world accustomed to death. They tell of unexpected beginnings to a world accustomed with expected endings. By their own unique spirit-driven, Jesus-honoring way, they do so, saying with and without words, I have seen the Lord. In the illustration before us, we see the beloved disciple, we see Peter, we see Mary, and we see ourselves and our church, and each one of them cherished, complicated, commissioned. In the end, however, what John wants to make sure that we see what's especially needing to be seen, which is Jesus the Christ, the one who blesses, the one who redeems, the one who sends. In his life and death and life again, Jesus is God's incarnated portrait on display for all to see. And we have seen Jesus' love. Sometimes you have to watch somebody love something before you can love it yourself. It's like they are showing you the way. That's what the love of God does for us in Jesus. Showing us the way to go. Jesus cannot go back to his pre-Good Friday self any more than the beloved disciple can. Any more than Peter can, any more than Mary can, any more than we can, because today is Easter Sunday. The new day has brought new creation, and they cannot go back to what once was. Mary and Peter and the beloved cannot cling to Jesus because he is not returning to them. He's returning to God with the improbable plan of bringing the world with him. This plan is not a completed still life piece of art hung on a museum wall, but an unfolding work of grace, the tip of the brush on the canvas even now. The story has not completed, but is ongoing, driven by resurrection. It's the ongoing story that we, because of Christ, have grown to love. Sisters and brothers, Christ has died. Christ has risen. And Christ will come again. Hallelujah and amen. Let's stand and worship together.